everybody involved and move forward with that. So I really would ask you to slow this process down a little bit, get input from everybody involved, both the folks that are affected and the folks that are pushing this proposal, and let's sit down and make this a better something that works better for everybody involved, because this is getting needlessly involved. We think we need to have that access at this, during the interview process, and frankly, having our input at the end on the administrative rules means the things we object to are already in case, and all we're doing is dealing with how you're going to enforce the issue, and that's really not where we want the input.
Thank you. Question for both employer groups. Do you either of you publish a standard employment application now for your members, and or have you done anything in terms of recommending that your members take the box off their application now, regardless of law?
I'll go first. No, we got out of that years ago, on providing the application itself. Yeah. We don't do that anymore. And B, no, the issue hasn't been come up, but in discussions with folks as I'm getting ready to come talk with you,
yeah.
I don't think they're absolutely against it, and some already have it off the application. Don't even have it already.
I mean, I know there's some standard forms out there, Stevens Nest and so forth, that in some cases still have the box on it. So I was just wondering if you've done anything in terms of voluntary efforts among your members.
Mayor. I'm sorry, Steve, was your answer that you do?
They don't.
You
they
have
don't.
Removed the box?
My answer is we don't supply the applications. And B, in talking with some of my members just to see what was going on, some have said we took it off already. We don't use it now. So it's a little bit of everything out there.
Mayor Hills, we have a number of members that have also voluntarily removed the box. We don't have any history or practice of providing kind of standard employment applications encouragement. I mean, we've taken a position saying we should ban the box. So I think that's an open question that I can bring back. But some of our members are also national employers who, you know, the decisions about what their applications look like are way above my and our pay grade.
Okay, great. Thank you. No, well, back when I worked for his organization, we published a lot of standard forms. So that's one of
the things. We quit doing that. The advent of the electronic age sort of did away with a lot of that stuff.
Steve, I apologize if this came up a couple of weeks ago when I was out of town, but I am curious as to how exactly this topic tends to come up in the interview process. I mean, is it really the case that you're interviewing somebody who's going to have access to hotel rooms and you ask, have you ever been convicted of a theft?
I guess I've got a personal example since I've been managing the association, and it had to do with an accounting person. And we hired an accounting person that came through one of our members and highly, you know, pushed them in. It said they'd be doing a great job, brought her in about a week and a half in, and I didn't ask about criminal history, that background. I went through what she'd done in her, you know, education, those things. So we get a call from the Beaverton Police Department, and this person had been was up and waiting trial for embezzlement, and a major embezzlement. It was way more than anybody got out of our little association. But when I then went in and confronted her, she says, well, yeah, that is the case. Did it occur? Yes, it did occur. I said, well, sorry, I can't keep you in this job handling the money we've got coming in here, and had to let her go. Since then, when it comes to those jobs where it's handling funds, where I need to be sure we're fine here, it gets asked. I ask about the criminal history. Do we have something you need to discuss that we need to know about? And frankly, I asked them at that point, I'd like to do a criminal background check on that. And specifically, that's pretty the only job in the company I do it with. But it's the only job where we're at risk, and there's, you know, we're in danger of experiencing not a good experience. So we do it then.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Appreciate your help. Thanks. Okay, who's next?
We have Trudy Cooper from the previous list. And if anybody else signed up from the previous March 11th, please let me know. And then we're going to go with Simon Brooks and Marcia Hayes.
Hi.
Okay, Ms. Cooper, you're next.
Hi, I'm Trudy Cooper. I live and work in the Elliott neighborhood. I want to focus on, first of all, I love it that my city has brought this forward, and I only want to focus on the, 2310050. As an organization development consultant, I've worked with many employers on their hiring and other practices, and the area of the rules where the required process if the decision is to retract the offer. I see some potential weaknesses there, at least in my understanding of the way that I'm reading it. So first, I'm wondering about the turnaround time for the employer being only 2 days to evaluate the applicant's appeal of an adverse employment decision. I've worked for many HR departments, and I've never seen anybody, I mean, rarely do I see them do a turnaround of 2 days on the having received a complaint. So I don't see in the text what the rationale is for that, and I don't see what the penalty is if they don't bring about that turnaround time. And since the analysis contains about a half dozen considerations that are presented by the applicant in the event of a request for a reconsideration, I think is the terminology, it seems like a longer time might be more practical. And then second, the notification instructions from the employer to the applicant in the case of an adverse decision seem to lack specificity, that it seems that it is a disadvantage to the applicant to not have the specific information. I don't see any indication that the employer is required to communicate to the applicant the nature of the additional information that is going to be needed when they whatever the process is for the reconsideration of the factors. And while the list of factors seem to be sound, I don't see where the employer is required to include that on the list of instructions to show, in other words, the nature, time, nature analysis. And there's a list of, I think, 8 things that they may bring to that reconsideration, whether that's written or a meeting, I don't know. But 5 of those 8 things are pretty substantive, and it seems that they should be indicated. And then third, the decision seems to be left entirely up to the employer, and I think this has been discussed, that it's procedural. You know, the employer can still simply say, uphold their decision to retract the offer. And maybe, I'm not understanding the scope or appreciating that the scope is only to delay and have that conversation before pulling the criminal record. But it seems that there ought to be some way that to demonstrate more than just that you went through the motions of the nature, time, nature, as opposed to there being any hearing or consideration during a complaint process where the quality of that analysis could be questioned or could be reconsidered. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you. Welcome. You're next.
Hi. I'm Judy Cirillo. I'm a member of the Partnership for Safety and Justice, and I'm just very concerned about the number of people we have in prison. I read The New Jim Crow. I hope other people have read it. It really explains what we're doing to people, and especially people of color, locking them up. And many times they're young children, really, who don't make good decisions and end up in jail for something that's relatively minor or end up in some kind of prison. So I just want to talk. I don't have a lot of facts and figures. I talk from the heart because I feel it's such an emotional issue to think of your child possibly being locked up. I mean, I thank God that I am a white person. I think if I were raising a black son nowadays, I would be very, very concerned. What else did I want to say? You have to think of what happens to the family also when someone is incarcerated. If a child's father is incarcerated, there's no man in the family. There's no one to be a role model for him. A man or a woman could have made a mistake, but they still need to be at home with their children. So the children, I have a good friend whose teenage, her daughter, I should say, was incarcerated, and the teenage children were left to float around, and she was supposed to take care of them. She was a woman in her 70s, and she could not really have any control over these kids. So they didn't go to school, and they got into all kinds of trouble. I don't think we've really looked at the outcomes when we just say, okay, check the box and you're in prison because you did something that you shouldn't have done. I have a granddaughter myself who managed to get herself into a lot of trouble. She was driving under the influence and various things like that. And luckily, there was a lawyer in the family who went to bat for her, and she didn't go to prison. And today she's a young mother, and she's a wonderful person. So if she were black, I don't think that would have happened unless there were some unusual circumstances. And I think we really have to look at that and think about it. It's completely unfair. I don't know if I have my... Oh, I saw a wonderful video last night, which I wanted to mention, and was done by Second Chances for Everyone, which is a group that tries to help people coming out of prison. And it really brought tears to my eyes to see this man who was like in his late 30s or early 40s. He'd been locked up for 14 years. He came out. Of course, your family hardly knows you after 14 years. He tried to get a job. Nobody would employ him. And he was just sort of at the point where he was thinking, I'm going to be back in prison. And the Second Chance for Everyone came to his rescue and managed to help him get a job. And he was so grateful. And he's been out of trouble. Even if you think of the cost of sending that person back to prison, I think they said it's like $35,000 a year to keep someone incarcerated, where he could be out earning a living and getting a life back together. So I think that's mainly it. It's an important thing to talk about. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Mayor Hills and commissioners. My name is Simone Brooks. I'm the president of Brooks Staffing. I'm also a co-owner. Our company's mission is to provide employment solutions for employers and applicants that enhance and diversify the workforce. The majority of our work consists of providing temporary, temp-to-hire, and contract staff to private and public sector employers. The majority of our staff are located in the Portland metro area. The nature of our work results in exposure to companies ranging in size from small to large in numerous industries and with a variety of hiring timetables and practices. Our experience has shown us that there are companies that will use the admission of a criminal background, for example, on an application, as a means of weeding people out. We have long recognized that solely relying upon the admission of a criminal background to make an adverse hiring decision not only unnecessarily thins the labor pool, but more importantly, negatively and disproportionately impacts communities of color in terms of opportunities for employment. Prior to November of 2014, we included the box on our applications. However, we used the information provided for two reasons. One, to start a dialogue with our applicants about their backgrounds and possible implications for which client locations they could be at. And two, to compare against the criminal background record obtained should one be needed given the position being applied for. In November of 2014, we moved to an online application and removed the criminal background question. Please note that at the time of the interview, we do discuss with our applicants their criminal background, specifically convictions as opposed to arrests, and the possible implication in terms of potential placements, again, positions and clients. For example, a warehouse where food is being shipped and received is very different than if there's high-level material or very high-worth material being shipped and received. Further, the same business that ships and receives high-end merchandise may have different requirements for a receptionist versus someone that's in their warehouse. I am supportive of removing criminal background inquiries from applications. However, I am not in support of the ordinance as drafted, particularly the requirement for a conditional offer of employment. For instance, this ordinance does not take into consideration that in the temporary staffing industry, often a written conditional offer of employment is never issued. Often because the applicant has already applied with us, is no longer in our office, and may need to go on assignment the next day, we often verbally discuss employment details. While we may send an assignment confirmation, the conditional offer as defined in this ordinance does not always occur. Further, the ordinance does not take into consideration that the turnaround time for staffing agencies receiving a request to filling a position is often hours or mere days, rarely even a week. It can take a day or more for a criminal background check to be completed. If we know that an individual is interested in certain types of positions, we may run the criminal background check specifically so that we can discuss any issues and be prepared to place them on assignments that will work for them. I believe the purpose of this ordinance is to allow qualified applicants to build rapport with employers. We think that can be done at the interview process.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you all very much.
Actually, I did want to ask Ms. Brooks a question. So, what would you have us do here? I mean, I recognize the temporary staffing is a different kind of animal, and I did ask this question of the attorneys yesterday. You know, I had a hard time imagining that somebody hiring a line cook, for example, does a conditional offer. You, And I guess their answer was, well, if you choose not to do criminal backgrounds on anybody, then you're free to offer whoever you like as a line cook. So what would you have us do to meet the particular circumstances of your business?
I think allowing to have that discussion at the interview stage, whether that be a phone interview or in-person interview, would solve a lot of those problems just to be able to have the discussion. The fact that there's even an exception in the ordinance that basically says if they voluntarily tell me, then I can talk about it. But I can't talk about it if they don't voluntarily tell me. And yet, if there's a big gap in employment, I'm going to say, well, why is there this gap? And I can't pursue that and try to understand the applicant. But I think the example that you gave about, let's say the line cook is working in an environment where many of the other employees are female and they stay late in order to clean the kitchen, do I need to be concerned about that as an employer? Perhaps.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you all very much. Thank you.
And the next three I show are Mary Ng. Oh, she's here. And Michelle Natividad Rodriguez and Christine Harbacek. Oh, sorry. Did I miss Marcia? I'm sorry. I thought, okay. Sorry.
Hey, Mary, why don't you go ahead and go?
Hi, my name is Mary Ng. I want to thank you for offering this proposal. I think currently in the current situation with Ferguson and the protests going around, there was a young man killed in Atlanta recently with post-traumatic stress from Afghanistan. We have unassessed needs surrounding the issue of racial profiling. And I feel that that's not what, it's not really, it's sort of like we're saying one thing, but what we're really saying is that our police are unfairly targeting a certain demographic and rubber stamping them with a permanent scarlet letter F for felon, when maybe their crime was related to their poverty or to systemic racism or to self-protection, like the young man who kept a gun on him in his neighborhood just because he wanted to be safe. He didn't want to go home dead. And I think in some ways we are also acting as if the DA is omnipotent and somehow has a handle on crime. We know that there are massive levels of failed prosecution. I know that all three of my rapists walked free. And one of them, I don't even know his name. So I don't know where he is, whether he's alive or dead, working or not. I know that I've been a victim of sexual harassment in a wide variety of contexts, and that frequently serious crimes are committed by people with no prior background. And actually, people who are convicted of crimes can be some of the nicest, most reformed people you ever met. And so I think there's sort of a, trying to make this into a boxy kind of issue is hard on my brain, because we have a very harsh employment law atmosphere here in Oregon, where I ran into a woman who was trying to raise enough money to visit her parents in Korea by working 14-hour shifts in Starbucks. And I'm thinking, well, in California, you'd at least have overtime pay after 8.5 hours. And I think we need to look more at comprehensive overhaul of the employment law systems, as well as issues surrounding the Innocence Project with wrongful convictions and framing and preventing racial profiling and building up our communities so we don't have this prison system of cheap, below minimum wage prison labor, which is being exploited, and we don't have disability assessment for prison rape victims who come out and then are supposed to join the labor community and be exploited and not have proper benefits. There's a lot going on. But thank you for listening. I live in felony flats, and I can tell you the unregulated industries which will not apply to this box culture are the meth, the scrap metal, the panhandling, the strip clubs, the stick-ups, and the car break-ins, which I had a car break-in just a few days ago in my mother's drive lot. So there's a lot going on in felony flats that I'd love you to check out, but maybe you could set up some kind of work center to get people involved in things other than crystal meth.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Welcome.
Hello, sir, Mayor.
There's a button on the bottom of that microphone in front of you. There you go.
Good evening, afternoon. My name is Christine Harbacek, and I support Ban the Box because it gives a hiring system a throwaway issue in regards that when they see the box, they don't want to hire a person. I have spent 18 years in prison, and I've had my trouble in coming out and looking for work. And in the process of looking for work, I have been told that my credentials and my ableness to do the job was acceptable. My resume passed. Yet, because of the box issue and the reason why I was wrongfully convicted, which is related to a sexual offense, kept me from getting employment, kept me from being hired. I've lived and worked prior to this without any problem paying taxes, and as of yet coming out of a situation which has labeled me into somebody that I'm not, which is a stigma, that puts me in a category of situations non-related to me, but legally related to me, which now I have to apply by, which is I belong on paper. I have since been employed by Sportsman's Warehouse, and I will be there July, going into my third year. The first 90 days of being there, I was employee of the month and given a pay raise. I have been supporting myself by using the money from the schooling, from the money that I received from the job, to repay myself back to go back to school for the student loan that was in deferment for a long while. And I've since put myself back into school, and I'm into my third term, and this is spring break. My employee now allowed me to come here today for understanding the seriousness and the understanding of how personal and related it was for me to be here. I work at Sportsman's Warehouse on 82nd, and they have been great in supporting it of me and working with me towards my education and towards helping me get back into society. Mike Gray is the initial hiring guy that hired me, and his question to me then was, they won't let you get past this. Very true. As long as we have the stigma about these cases that come before hiring people, you will not have productive people coming back into society that want to work. And you won't get people to pay taxes, and you're going to be losing money by sending them back into prison instead of just using the past and using it in the present and tying the two together as if they're the one and the same person. And they may not even be that person at all to begin with, but the law assess them, judgment, preconceive them into somebody, and sent them away. And the time frame that was spent in prison does not only take away from the individual of who they are or not, but also the time frame is lacking as far as educational inside prison and how to come out of prison into a world that is foreign. And cell phones is all foreign to me. And it's a totally different world you walk into. And they expect, within a matter of X amount of time frame, to be employed. And that can't be done with the box still on the application. The application boxes you in, confines you, and doesn't help you move forward. It deters the whole effect of what I'm sure you guys aren't here today to have is people going back into prison, and you guys have a tax money going into an area that it is $35-$40 a year, to keep one inside. That money could be better off in us coming out, paying taxes, and supporting back the city. And I just thank you for listening.
Thank you for being here. Thank you very much.
Welcome. Any questions?
Good luck to you. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, my name is Marcia Hayes. I am a current job seeker. Really sorry that I missed the initial hearings. What I have here is my background check from a potential employer that I interviewed with last week, I believe. They send it to me, and 14 days later, they send it to the employer. Now, I may or may not get this job based on this. It also doesn't help that one charge that I have or one conviction that I have. It's listed multiple times, and so it looks like I've committed this crime multiple times when it was actually only one time. That doesn't help. I understand the logic of the keeping that criminal background check there. It is necessary in some cases. The nature time nature approach. The nature of my crimes or my conviction or crimes period, I think the circumstances should be looked at more in depth. When you're, I have to condense this because it's just so long. So on the applications where it says, have you ever been convicted of a felony? I'm always honest. I'm very transparent about my life. I say yes, and then there's a box that says, if yes, please explain. And there's a little tiny box. And so working with Project something up on 47th and Killingsworth, I learned how to write a letter of disclosure. So I say, please see letter of disclosure. So I have my letter of disclosure that explains the circumstances surrounding my convictions. You know, I'm a child rape survivor. I am a trafficking survivor. I'm a DV survivor. I'm a substance abuse survivor. Like so many things that happened in my life as a result of things that were out of my control and led me to make some poor choices because I didn't know how to make good choices. Back then, I never heard anything about DV shelters or rape. All I know is I had been violated and, you know, having my child kidnapped and murdered and no justice behind those things. Nothing in life made sense to me. Like, I didn't have the ability to make good decisions. Being in an abusive relationship where I asked for help, I asked the police for help. There was nothing they could do for me. So I had to stay in that situation and be trafficked and be beat and make choices that instead of jumping in and out of cars with strange men and risking them killing me, I made other choices that I didn't understand at the time. I was victimizing someone. I didn't have the ability to make those good choices. Moving forward, at some point in my life, of course, you know, the drugs and all that stuff came along with all that and, you know, looking for love in all the wrong places and things like that. When this person was removed out of my life because of something he had finally got caught for after many, many years of enduring that abuse, then I began to understand that the negative effects of my life were a direct result of the negative choices I made. Like, I'm not making excuses, but I've come up with a theory as to why I was making those choices. And so I wanted some positive events to occur in my life, and so I started making some more positive choices. I'm a certified domestic and sexual abuse advocate. I'm a certified Christian counselor through Good Samaritan Ministries. I went back to school and got a bachelor's in social work. I went back to school and got a master's of science and management and organizational leadership with a nonprofit management emphasis because, as this lady stated down here, there needs to be more education within the prison system to rehabilitate as opposed to retribution. My thesis is shifting the burden, and that's what we do. We throw people in prison. They do have to pay for the mistakes that they made. However, while they're in prison, what are we doing for them while they're in prison? And then what are we doing for them when they get out? So that's this whole thesis is about this thing here. And I made a lot of mistakes. But as a result of, have you ever been convicted? Yes, I have. If yes, please explain. Now, I don't know how many of these attachments that I sent in, I don't know how many of them were read and said, what, these charges? Oh, my God. Okay, dump. I have gotten some interviews. I have been on a lot of interviews. At this point, I've been looking for work since August. I can't get work. I've had 2 and 3 and 5 interviews for one organization. I lack experience. I lack the experience that other people have. I have the credentials. I'm qualified. But I lack the experience, and I lack that experience because I can't get in anywhere. I can't get in anywhere. Mm-hmm. I'm at risk right now being homeless because I can't get in anywhere. I can't even display these in my home because they mean nothing to me anymore. I worked hard. I worked really, really hard to... It's like I didn't have help. I didn't have any help. I made a choice to seek professional help for the trauma that was imposed on me by myself and by other people. I had to go do that for myself. I made a choice to go to school and persevere through 5.5 years. This is determination, perseverance. I needed to do this for me. Now I need to go to work in my community and help other people that are going through or stuck in where I once was. And then I need to be able to go to work and do like you guys do, pay my taxes. I want to pay taxes. You know why? Because I want to pay for the taxes. I don't know if it's tax money that goes for shelters or domestic violence shelters or any kind of resources that are going to help somebody's medical, mental health, or medical. I don't mind because it has worked for me. It has helped me. I want to go to work. I want to be a productive member of society. But because of some mistakes that I made, and it was 30-something years ago, and people say, leave your past in your past and move forward. I think I've moved forward. But every time I turn around, somebody is bringing it back to me. I'm not proud of this. I don't even like looking at it because it brings up issues for me. When people reject me for employment, they have no idea the circumstances that led to this. They weren't there when I was getting my face beaten and then told to go get my money. They weren't there when I endured all this. It keeps coming back to haunt me. And at this point, I'm real discouraged. I'm tired. And I see why people recidivate. They have expectations when they get out of prison to go get a job. You have to get employment, but you keep going and you keep going and you keep going and you keep getting rejected. Everybody doesn't have the foundation that I have. Thank God for the foundation that I have that allows me to keep forging ahead. Everybody's not that strong will. They give up and they go back to what's familiar to them. So I think that, you know, I do understand the logic in having it there, but then I do think that, and I think somebody said it here, there needs to be more dialogue around how that's going to really work, because how do you know if somebody has violated the policy that they currently have in place? How do I know that, you know, that, like, the people didn't already do the background check before they offered me the job? Generally, in if the box is not on the application, and we're talking about it, and I know that they're going to do a background check, I initiate the dialogue. I initiate and say, okay, look, this is how it is. Because I don't want to waste your time, and I don't want you to waste my time and get my hopes up and have me thinking that I have a possible, you know, job, and then knowing that because that list that that lady talked about is going to weed me out. At one time, Oregon did have this long list. There was this permanent disqualifiers. There's the 10-year disqualifiers, and there's the 5-year disqualifiers. And most of my convictions were in permanent disqualifiers. So that, thank God that that list was shortened. So it's like murder and arson and you know, sex crimes and things like that. I was offered a job that I actually didn't apply for. I got a call, and I had to go through the DHS way test, what they call the way test now, where I presented everything that I've done. And I had a stack of letters of character references from people who knew that I had made some significant changes in my life. And I think that those are the type of things, because I heard somebody say, I think just word of mouth from me saying, oh, well, yeah, I've done this, this, that, and the other. Where's your proof? You know, where's your documentation? You know, I think those kind of things should be implemented in there. I think a certain amount of time should be implemented in order to exclude someone.
I want to ask you to wrap up, even though we so appreciate you being here. And I think all three of you, with your personal experience, have really informed our understanding of why this is so important. So thank you. Thank you all for being here and for being courageous enough to come forward and tell us your stories and why this matters.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And we wish you well. And I believe there's an employer who's going to see why you will be such a great asset to their organization. And I hope that happens really soon.
Yeah, me too. I believe it too. It's just a matter of when. I don't want to be pushing a shopping cart down the street with this stuff in it looking for work.
So Ms. Hayes, that was really compelling, and I appreciate you sharing your story. When you have boarded up at the interview stage, what has been the response of the employer at that?
Well, two things. The one for this one, they appreciated my transparency. They had the information beforehand. I also left them with my letter of disclosure. Yesterday, I got a call from a potential employer. Well, I had gotten an email, and it was for a legal advocacy specialist for domestic violence, YWCA. And she sent this. She sent me a list of things to do, to call for the phone screen, blah blah blah, and the background check. So in the background check, there was these convictions that would disqualify me. So I called her and left a message. I let her know, unfortunately, my convictions fall under, you know, your list. She called me back and she says, look, you qualify. She said, I want you to consider going ahead with the phone screen. And she called me back yesterday and said that she had new information, and because I would be working, well, the person in that position would be working with prosecutors, that they had such strict guidelines that prohibit me from having that job. And so they couldn't offer me the job, which is, it was pretty devastating, because I'm probably the one that the prosecutors want to work with.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So, you know, that whole thing, it's kind of, it's a give and take. It's complex, and then it's like, I think it should just be on an individual basis. And I heard somebody say, you know, like using your best judgment, but two, not having me sit with a group of people doing an interview that is not making the final decision, and then you guys go back and tell the actual hiring manager or the actual person who has the say, so you guys going and telling them my story instead of allowing me to speak with the individual who's going to make the final decision, because I can share my story better than you can. I can express my, you know, I'm like...
Well, I'm glad that the YWCA, that was a step forward, and then they hit a roadblock, but that employer was willing. I know that Janice Youth and some others actually prefer having people with a criminal history, because you're then able to relate to the youth that they serve, that you've been in their situation. So
it goes back to experience. Like, I've had several interviews with the Healing Root Center, which I volunteered for after completing my training, my certification, volunteered there. And every time that there's a position open and it comes down to me and someone else, you know, this other person has more experience, and I'm not getting experience because I'm not getting in the door.
Well, maybe they need to start considering your life experience, which is certainly
that's
compelling.
What I asked them, and
so keep going.
I actually had a job with Volunteers of America Home Free Program. And I didn't actually have the job. I interviewed really well. And at the end of the interview, one of the ladies, like, let me see her resume. And she looked at my resume and says, well, this is a high-level position, and they require that you have 2 years. And I said, well, my life experience doesn't count. They said, no, we'll have to talk to HR. We might have to repost this position. They send me an email later and say, you know, you interviewed well, your skills, qualifications, all that was spot on, but as we stated, this is a high-level position, and they require that you have 2 years' experience, and for that reason, we cannot offer you the job.
Well, keep going, because I know that at some point you're going to be a tremendous asset to some company, and I hope you'll come back and tell us about that.
I will.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Ban the box.
Thank you. All right, do we have some others still testifying?
Yes, the last two I show are Michelle Natividad Rodriguez and Patty Katz.
Come on up.
Hi, I'm Michelle Natividad Rodriguez. I'm with the National Employment Law Project, and I'm very pleased to be here today. I actually heard our organization's name mentioned earlier. If you're not familiar with our organization, NELP, it's a national organization, much as the name suggests. We have offices across the country, and I actually came here today in part for this hearing and in part for a hearing in Salem on Ban the Box Bill there. And we do actually focus on fair hiring reform. We're one of the leaders in the national movement, and I keep track of all of the jurisdictions across the country, compile data, information, have been consulting with and working with advocates across the country, and have worked now with dozens of jurisdictions on their policies. So I hope to bring those experiences here today. And in fact, some of the themes that have come up and that I've heard today, I have to say, they are the same themes that have come up across the country, and where I think you all have the benefit of is to learn from the experiences from years now of policies in place in other places, and as well as individual jurisdictions are going through the process of implementation and enforcement now. Because this issue around private employer enforcement, this is something that's coming up. It's the next edge of the fair hiring movement. There are now six states and about a couple of dozen jurisdictions that have at least something in terms of their policy or law that apply to private employers, whether that's city contractors or the whole scope of private employers. So there's a good amount of experience. And I also worked personally on some of the advocacy in San Francisco and actually compiling a report on robust enforcement and implementation that I hope I can share with the commissioners and the mayor, and I hope that that will be helpful. And some of the themes that were talked about earlier are some of the pieces that we would recommend. I want to focus in on, there's so many things I could focus in on, but I want to focus in on specifically on this provision around voluntary disclosure that has come up, because I think it has the tendency to be very appealing. So the voluntary disclosure provision basically says that if you have a voluntary disclosure during the process, then basically, it circumvents the law. You can go ahead and talk about the conviction history, and you don't have to wait until the condition or offer stage. That may make a lot of sense at first blush. In fact, that's very problematic. It actually sidesteps the entire law, and part of it is has been hinted at from what you heard earlier. Individuals are taught to self-disclose. So you're basically looking at a population that is being told they self-disclose. And if we're talking about a budget of $500,000 in terms of outreach and education, that would be just the tip of the iceberg in terms of trying to shift the entire culture of how that operates. So I would recommend not having that particular component. I haven't been able to touch upon the other components of enforcement, so I will make sure to put together some documentation for you and different principles that I hope will be helpful.
Your counsel will be very helpful, along with others that we've heard from today as we refine this. So thank you very much.
I'd particularly like to hear your advice on, you know, which parts of our ordinance are better than, you know, build on the other ordinances, and which parts you would recommend getting rid of. I'm also interested to know what's happening with the bill at the state. What's happening at the state level?
It's having a hearing.
Yeah, we had a hearing today, and we will see from there. It was a hearing. There wasn't a vote at this point, and so we'll see when the vote does come up.
And is our ordinance modeled on theirs? How do they match, Mayor?
I can't answer that question. I don't know if Judy or
have some questions for later. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Could I just ask a quick question? I'd just like your quick reaction to the arguments you heard made about temporary staffing agencies or other situations where there's quick turnover and there might not normally be such a thing as a conditional offer.
Right. So that is something that has come up both in D.C. and San Francisco, and it's something that the enforcement agencies are working out right now. And I can certainly share their experiences and where they've landed. They've basically faced it in the administrative rules, but you could learn from those experiences and include something potentially in your provisions.
Thank you.
Do you, I'm sorry, do you have something that language that San Francisco or... I'm sorry, I forgot the other jurisdiction you mentioned. That
there are many jurisdictions. Some of the most robust ones are D.C. And San Francisco. There is also...
With respect to temporary staffing?
In terms of private employer ban the box, that's a very robust component, a fair hiring ordinance. They are working out at the administrative level how to deal with staffing agencies right now.
Okay. Go ahead.
Over here. My name is Patty Katz. I'm an Oregonian my whole life, which is a long life. I am a formerly incarcerated person. I got out of the system in 1994 and have been very fortunate, I think because of my age and my race, I've been able to get most jobs that I've applied for. My drug addiction didn't really kick in until I was 38 years old, and so I had a lot of life experience to bring to any employer that might ask. I went to work for a Partnership for Safety and Justice and started having conversations with a lot of people who were coming in and out of drug and alcohol treatment, in and out of reentry services. And many of the things that I have learned is when you are in drug and alcohol treatment, they say, be sure and tell the truth right away. When you are coming out of prison, one of the things they teach you in prison is tell the truth right away. I think as a woman in long-term recovery, I want to always tell the truth. However, I think when it's, and I have worked with a temporary staffing organization, and my application was thrown in the garbage while I was watching. So I applaud the staffing agency that has removed that box. I think that if I'm able to sit in front of someone and tell them the truth about what I did in my addiction and what I do today, I have a fair chance of being employed. Today I sit on the Governor's Reentry Council because of my past, not in spite of my past. I sit on several boards that have to do with prison to housing, family. I'm on the CURE board, which we talk about. We work with families, Department of Corrections, and Community Corrections to help families help their loved ones be more successful when they enter prison and when they exit prison. So I think there's a lot of education that needs to be done. I just surveyed 94 people and about their employment experience with a felony conviction, and I'm compiling that into a report, and I'm happy to share that with you guys when I'm finished. But I really encourage us to let people have an opportunity to get back into the workforce, to become successful. A chance that was given to me, I would like given to everyone. And it's going to take a lot of education with HR departments, with the prisons, and the reentry people who are saying, tell the truth, tell the truth, tell the truth. And I think that often we shoot ourselves in the foot when we tell the truth too soon before we tell about our experience, our education, our resumes, our gifts, our skills. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Anyone else that wants to speak? So can we bring our staff back up for questions and guidance from council and talk about next steps?
I guess I have a suggestion I'd like to make. Okay. Sure. Judy. I would like to take the language
from finding number 8 in the ordinance and put it into the code, Exhibit A.
Sir, it is in the code. I looked.
I know we talked about this yesterday. So I was looking at the last sentence. The last sentence
in
says
2310030C. It's not the exact wording, but it is the concept. An employer may rescind a conditional offer of employment or take another adverse employment action based upon a person's criminal history if an employer determines in good faith that a specific offense or conduct has a direct relationship to a person's ability to perform the duties or responsibilities of the employment.
So when you say it's not exactly the same, how is it different? I guess I'd...
Well, it's code wording versus policy wording in the ordinance.
Yeah, making an individualized assessment, determining in good faith.
It pretty much says the same thing. In 8, it says an employer who makes an individualized assessment, that's one factor of a person's criminal history and determines in good faith, another factor that it has a direct relationship, yet a third factor to the person's ability to perform the duties of the particular job.
Why is the word individualized assessment in finding number 8 but not in code section 0.30C, I guess? Is there some...
If you look at C and D together, D, the whole A, B, C, and D sort of blend into each other. And so if you look at C followed by D, it says, in making the determination of whether a person's criminal history has a direct relationship, so forth and so on, an employer must conduct an individualized assessment of the factors. I think what happened in 8, it's just really more of a policy phrase, and then we broke it out in A, B, C, and D of 23.10.030.
Okay. Was that the issue we brought up yesterday with you? I know.
Yes.
Yeah, that was it. Okay.
So other questions, instructions, follow-up recommendations?
And first of all, Ms. Prosper, I apologize for getting your name wrong earlier. It's been a long day.
It's okay. I didn't even notice. It's been a long day for me, too.
Thank you. So I would like a request to amend to say that when you're creating and amending administrative rules, that council offices will also be notified. You and I had talked about that. I'm interested to see that you're assigning the enforcement to the code hearings officer rather than to a new department within the city attorney's office. So that's different from what I had understood, and obviously the code hearings officer is under the auditor.
The code hearings officer is what we have in the city currently, who is sort of the neutral arbiter of code, sort of the judge of code violations. What we're proposing is to leave that procedural piece with the code hearings officer, but the case would be brought by a city entity, and it could be the city attorney's office, it could be another office created, but using the same procedural mechanism of the code hearing officer.
So, Commissioner Fritz, I think I sort of envision this as a two-stage process. One is, as I indicated in my discussion with Commissioner Saltzman earlier, I think over the next year, there will be a number of us at the city looking at and bringing forward recommendations to you about how we could better do code enforcement and civil rights enforcement in the city going forward. The ordinance is set up to reflect what we currently have, which is that the city attorney's office would receive complaints, that enforcement would be done, and that those hearings would be conducted by the code hearings officer. Even if we were to move to additional enforcement authority, that might well be with a beefed up code hearing structure. But so I think it's sort of a two-stage, I see it at least as a two-stage process. One is, how would we implement this using our existing code hearings process? The other is taking a enterprise look at how do we want to do more broadly civil rights enforcement going forward.
So the code hearings officer under the auditor charges $1,300 for an appeal. And the auditor is concerned about that and looking to make sure that people with low incomes aren't excluded from the code hearings process. So that needs to be factored into the proposed cost.
It does. The way that this is structured, it would be the city attorney or whatever enforcement, whoever ended up with that enforcement responsibility, initially the city attorney, who would be filing those. It wouldn't be the individual person. The individual person would be bringing in a complaint to...
But the code hearings office will not accept your code complaint unless you accompany it with a $1,300
and
check.
And I realize there's a lot going on around that, and there's current proposals, so we have not yet addressed that. I know that there is a request by the auditor to have that.
There is, and in my opinion, it's mess. I mean, when we talked about enforcement for, I forget if it was demolitions or Airbnb, It was demolitions. We were thinking if only 20% of the demolition permits got appealed, that would be $97,000 a year. So adding in another city bureau may greatly increase the cost, and I'm just flagging that for you, Mayor. Mm-hmm. And I'm also thinking that it maybe increases the complexity because our current, as you know, our current civil rights laws are enforced by BOLI. I did get the numbers from my chief of staff. We got a pittance for sick leave enforcement compared with what is being proposed here. We got $37,000 for BOLI, the contract with BOLI, and $31,500 for education and outreach, including a citywide mailing. So I'm really concerned about what does this program look like? What are we actually creating? What are we proposing to create here?
And to that end, in terms of next steps, I want to suggest one that we have had a long day, so I want to try to move to next steps. And one of those is I want to ask council offices to each supply a staff person for the working group, assuming folks are willing to send a member of each of our staffs to the table along with some of the folks that we've heard from today. And then also maybe at least have a notion about how long we want to wait for that process to do its work and refine the proposal and come back for council action. I would think that's somewhere between a month and 2 months, but want to take people's temperature about that.
Are you talking about convening a work group now before we act on the ordinance?
Yes.
Yes,
I do. I would like to do that.
Because I know the question of BOLI versus city attorney is something that Commissioner Fish was really interested in. He had another particular concern that I don't at this hour remember, but I'm sure he'll want to be involved.
So my sense is, again, there's some of these issues that can wait for administrative rules, but there's others that can't.
Right.
And in the effort to measure twice and cut once, it seems to me that if we bring the ordinance back in, say, 30 days or thereabouts, there's a discrete enough number of issues here, particularly timing. A lot of them are timing issues.
Yeah.
That we ought to be able to figure that out in fairly short order.
Thank you.
And again, if we have staff people plus folks from the community that have showed up and brought a lot to the table and national organizations as well, I think we've got people of goodwill with willingness to roll up their sleeves. Marianne is still here.
She's nodding.
We'll grab her. I mean, I'd love to have...
Her sleeves rolled up.
Thank you very much.
Some of you stayed long enough that you're going to get named individually, Ms. Cooper. I'd love to have involved as well as of course, we've had people from the Urban League involved in this all along, and she's still here, so you're in.
She's out pretty soon.
Yeah, that's right. Well, while we still got her. And Simone Brooks, I think, would be useful because of the staffing... the staffing company model as opposed to the standard employer model.
We had somebody on the sick leave.
There's a constellation of folks that we might recruit out of this room and who've otherwise been involved in the issue to work with our staff members. Josh Alpert, obviously, on my staff, has been involved in this from the beginning. But if we could set a date maybe 30 days from now and see if that work has been completed, and then we'll know what remains to be done in administrative rules. And then there is the budgetary question of what do we have to spend to make this work? And, again, a plug number for now, but a more refined one later.
I think that's a splendid suggestion. I think on sick time we didn't actually set a date for the next hearing we may have done. We had the general understanding it was going to be about 30 days, and then once we saw when we were done.
So we can continue the item without setting a date.
I think so, right?
Think that's right. All right, let's do that. But with an understanding that this isn't a 6-month project, it's a 6-week project.
Yeah. So if I might just put one more item on the table, and again, thinking to my experience employing folks, I agree that that face-to-face discussion of where there's a gap or where there's an issue that's can help explain to my satisfaction that this is indeed a great candidate that I want to offer the job to. I think if I was to go through that whole process and then do the background check and find a something, I would want to have that candidate come back in again and say, and have that conversation. So I'm wondering about the timeline to allow that to happen, that even under some, the, I could say, just say no, even if I